Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It certainly is great to be back on the air. Hard to believe we're already halfway through the week. But I know that, as always, I'm glad to be on the air with you guys, even if it's, in between where I'm on the air one night and I'm off for about 3 or 4 days. I'm very eager to get back on the air. But before getting back on the air, I have to do my homework, and that is be prepared for the next upcoming podcast and what I'm able to relay to you all information-wise, but to be able to go about accurately telling you all is what's far more important in terms of paraphrasing and consolidating the essential information. And I'm sure, some of you are probably wondering now, Kirk, how are you able to do this? Are you able to combine some chapters? Are you able to decide for yourself what's important to share and what's to be left out? Well, all that is a work of art. It takes time, but if you study the chapters and you can, thoroughly decide for yourself what is to be discussed and what needs to be held off, then you know that you are definitely going in the right direction and can do something very good in terms of telling the proper story, even if it means consolidating information. In other words, it's one thing to tell you all these stories that I've done per the books I've read, but at the same time, it does not also mean that you write down information page by page, because you never know, for one, how long the chapters might be, and two, if you're writing down information page by page, you're going to have, say, maybe 6 or 7 more episodes than you planned on having per book topic, regardless of not only just so much of the topic itself, but how big itself the book is. I mean, this one that we're doing about the frozen water trade and how ice from New England lakes kept the world cool, it's over 200 pages. But the key is to basically the key is to try to figure out what it is that you know is important to talk about, whether it's a chapter that consists of 12 pages or if it's a segment where you can combine two chapters and say it's 20 or 22 pages total, 12 pages for one and 10 pages for the other. If you know you can find a way to consolidate it where you can find useful information, say 3 pages per chapter and 3 for the other, then hey, more power in terms of being able to do it. And how ironic for this podcast segment episode, I was able, and I'm not saying any of this to brag, but for those of you who are able to consolidate and whom write and go about making it a practice to consolidate information, say within 2 chapters, more power in terms of being able to do it, because that does tell us right there that hey, for those of you who are very good at writing, and for those of us whom are getting there, that we really are on the right track in terms of not only knowing what's essential to share with others, whether it's a in-room class discussion or via live with podcasting. It just goes to show that, preparation is essential, because if we don't prepare before getting on the air and we try to do all this stuff on the air, then the harder it is for any of us to be able to relay all of the information that is essential in telling a good story based upon what it is that we've read. Well, what I do know is that in this podcast segment episode that we're going to be talking about, for one, it's a 6-pager, so we definitely have a lot of ground to cover. But the most important thing we have to learn about is, for one, is were there any lessons that Frederick Tudor himself was able to gain from his first ice venture down to St. Pierre, Martinique? In other words, we learned from the previous episode that he, yes, made $2,000 in sales, but lost about $4,000. And we also learned that when he arrived there, that there was no ice house built. And wouldn't it be fair to say that had he arrived with his brother William and cousin James Savage, that had they all gone down together, of course, William and James went down and they did some things, which we can give them credit for, but they didn't go about doing all the other steps. However, such as finding the right place for an ice house. But I do personally believe that had Frederick himself gone down there with them, he would have been able to have really taken things the extra mile by saying, hey, this is where we need to build the ice house. This is how it needs to be insulated. Of course, I don't know if he would have gotten the insulation part correct on the first try, but had he been down there, some things would have been a little bit more modified. But there again, it's all 50-50 hindsight. And once again, we've got to be reminded that that getting an ice house established, and not just so much the presence of one established with putting ice into the facility, but how to go about preserving the ice onto itself is a work of art that will be continuously learned throughout the series. We will also learn about various experimentations that Frederick himself conducted in terms of which substances were best used for insulation means and keeping the ice itself intact. So we have a lot of ground to cover, so we better get the show on the road before it's too late. So here we go with our first leadoff question to this podcast segment episode of Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool. Here we go. Despite having lost a significant sum of money down in Martinique per his first ice venture, what truly made Frederick so persistent going forward? Well, for one, his pride. Maybe I should say his personal pride. You know, it's one thing to have pride, but if we're not careful, pride can become something dangerous. It's one thing to take a lot of pride in something. Yes, I enjoy podcasting, but if there's one thing that I don't do, and I'm not saying this for show, but I'm telling you all the truth. If there's one thing I don't do is I don't go around and flaunt it. And the reason I say that is because I know there are a lot of other people out there who, for one, podcast about various things of historical significance. But two, there are probably plenty of other people out there whom are able to podcast on such topics that I'm familiar with myself, such as the Boston Massacre, War of 1812. So the bottom line is, for me, it is not my place to go around and flaunt what I know, because if I do that, I will lose people like you all, my listeners. I will also lose other people in general. You know, it's one thing to have a talent. It's one thing to be passionate about something. But if you flaunt it too much, your pride will get the better of you to the point where various other people might simply just not want to have anything to do with you. But yes, for Frederick here, his personal pride in this mission he is pursuing, it's up there. He's not flaunting this, but for Frederick, the reason why he wants to make this grand dream or this grand scheme all the more possible is because so many other people, most notably the Brahmins, the Bostonian elites, viewed shipping ice as a commodity that really had no value, because in their eyes, all they see is the negative. Well, who's going to want a loaded commodity placed onto a ship that's going to melt before it leaves dock? But if it hasn't melted by the time it leaves dock, and who's to say once it does melt, that the whole venture itself will be worthless and it'll be nothing more than one recurring deficit after another. So for Frederick, his mission is to make money out of a commodity which other New Englanders, most notably the Brahmins, had viewed as being worthless. So it is fair to say that for Frederick Tudor, that yes, his family comes from is well-to-do. They are part of the Brahmin inner circle, but maybe we should be reminded of the fact that that there's that phrase called crabs in a barrel, and sometimes it's easy to associate that phrase with the lower tier of society. But we should be reminded of the fact that crabs in a barrel, if there are people who are crabs in a barrel, they are not always from the lower tiers of society. They often can be from the upper tiers of society within an elite inner circle, trying to pull others down whom want to do something that's uncommon, something that's different, something that's different that goes beyond the sky's ceiling. And that's what Frederick Tudor is trying to prove. Well, one lesson that Frederick Tudor himself was able to gain from the first ice venture journey down to St. Pierre, Martinique, revolved around the fact that a well-designed ice house had to already be in place by the time which the delivery shipment itself happened, thus allowing for small quantities to be sold over weeks, including months. So, had there been an ice house already established, already been built and set in place by the time of Frederick's arrival, it's probably fair to say that that he would have had more than $2,000 in sales. And it's also fair to say that yes, some ice would have melted, but not as much. How much that would not have melted had an ice house already been put in place? That's all speculation, because he never actually noted in his journal how much ice he lost. Maybe he was too embarrassed to want to reveal the statistics or to reveal the losses, to where it would have just led to further laughter by those whom would do nothing more but ridicule like there was no tomorrow. The summer and fall of 1806 saw Frederick making multiple contacts in the Caribbean, which resulted in his setting up agents on Jamaica, Barbados, Guadalupe, to St. Thomas. He even arranged for an ice house to get built in St. Pierre. He had a strong contact in Havana through extended family. Brother William was unable to convince Spanish government officials in Cuba to be given sole authority for selling ice, but nonetheless he prevailed to where he got permission to get an ice house that would be built in Havana. Here's a question that's going to seem a bit random, but I think it's still worth mentioning. Did anyone in particular own the frozen water of all New England ponds? Well, the answer is no. It should be an obvious no. And it's a good thing. And it's a very good thing for Frederick because, you know, given the fact that no one in particular owned the frozen water of all New England ponds, this means that Frederick himself could obtain supplies wherever he requested, ice being free. Where he requested ice being free is one good advantage and one strong source of solid, clear ice that could be found was none other than at Fresh Pond in Cambridge, where Harvard University is located, just on the outskirts of Boston. So for Frederick to be able to attain solid, clear ice at Fresh Pond in Cambridge, eventually, over time, he would be able to soon acquire a workforce there to cut ice. It's not going to happen overnight, but over time it will. And that will be a landmine unto itself. January of 1807, Frederick sent a second cargo of ice down south to the West Indies, but he didn't go along. It was a shipment of ice that went to Havana, Cuba, where it would get stored and sold by cousin William Savage. 180 tons, that's 36,000 pounds of ice, folks, that was shipped. And the good news to report here, folks, is that Frederick's cousin, I meant to say James Savage, not William Savage, because Frederick's brother is William Tudor. So actually, I take it back, never mind. The relative that was in Cuba was William Savage, who I believe was either a cousin to James Savage or his brother. So forgive me there if I may have said something incorrect. I know we've been mentioning William quite a bit in terms of Frederick's brother, William Tudor, but I should be reminded here that based upon what I had read when reading this book, there was a fellow named William Savage, whom was a cousin of Frederick Tudor's, but he is directly related to James Savage. So anyways, William Savage nonetheless found a very good market in Havana where demand for ice was high. It just so happened that the greatest demand for ice in Havana was amongst cafe owners. Now, would it be fair to say that those whom are going to cafes to eat in the early 19th century in Cuba are well-to-do people? Yes. Think of, you know, going to a cafe in Cuba is like the equivalent of dining at a fine tavern. So the cafe owners were the ones whom were buying the ice in great quantities, and they went about making chilled drinks to making ice cream. $6,000 worth of ice was sold. Boy, I tell you, that's a big step in the right direction compared to what Frederick Tudor himself experienced from the first go-around in St. Pierre, Martinique. Now, how many shipments of ice had Frederick made directly to Havana during the ice trade's second year? Three total. But despite the successes, the negative factors unfortunately still remain prevalent, most notably due to large sums of ice melting in the cargo hold upon arrival into port. So Frederick has got to figure out, he's going to have to figure out here soon what he could do differently, insulation, in the form of insulation, to go about preserving large sums of ice so that they don't melt in the cargo hold upon their arrival into port. And I'll mention that here shortly. But before we go there, there is some other, maybe we could call it breaking news, because when Frederick learns about this news, it might as well be breaking news, considering that there were no such things as televisions in the 19th century. Frederick didn't have access to a newspaper right away, but the news that he does get, he gets the news from someone else by word of mouth. So when he learns of this news, I will tell you this much right now, it's going to be a setback. It's not going to be a short-term setback, but it's going to be a long-term setback. So here we go. Frederick, he intended and ultimately did go south into Cuba come mid-December 1807. But right after arriving, he soon learned by word of mouth through someone else that Congress, under President Thomas Jefferson's request, enacted legislation closing U.S. ports to all exports and restricting imports from Great Britain. And of course, Thomas Jefferson, he is not a Federalist. He is, well, for one, he's an anti-Federalist. He is the leader of the Democratic Republican Party, or some would say the Jeffersonian Republicans. And of course, the Democratic Republicans are in the majority in both houses of Congress. This was all part of the Jeffersonian Revolution of 1800. So Thomas Jefferson's almost done with his presidency here, but he signs into law the Embargo Act of 1807. And I know I've mentioned this piece of legislation before in other podcast book topic series discussions, but I do know that Frederick will be deeply impacted by the embargo, this particular Embargo Act. Well, the reason why Congress signed this, enacted this legislation, was that, for one, American sailors are having a lot of difficulties on the high seas in terms of being able to make it from point A to point B to sell goods, and they're being stopped incessantly by British ships, not just so much the ships, but the crew on the British ships. They are making their way on board American vessels without any proper means of, without any valid means of conducting proper search and seizures. They're just making their way on there, and in doing so, without getting the consent of the American forces. So basically, they are practicing a practice that dates back to 1664 called impressment. They are seizing, coercing, forcing coercion on American sailors on the high seas and forcing them to join the ranks of the British against their own will. Britain is claiming they are experiencing a shortage of sailors on their side, but they are also intimidating American sailors to the point where they are literally taking them off their own vessels against their own will. So Jefferson signs the Embargo Act, thinking that if we, thinking that the British will come to their senses and end the practice of impressment altogether, that maybe the British will come to the realization that, hey, look, the Americans are serious. We're tired of being treated like dirt. You need to respect our sovereignty as an independent nation. We are hoping that with this embargo that Britain will also come to her senses and respect our rights to be neutral when on the high seas. Well, sadly, the legislation negatively impacted Americans far more than Britain. Roughly 10,000 New Englanders working along the ports, including Frederick Tudor himself, are now out of work. So you got people in Boston, folks, people in Salem, Marblehead, Gloucester, Massachusetts, people, employees around Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket. You got people, you got people working on the docks of the ports, a little bit north of Boston in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Other places like around Rhode Island, Connecticut. The bottom line is everybody in the New England region, and yes, down south there are impacts, but more so in the New England region where there's a higher population, and they are heavily dependent upon exporting manufactured goods to England. Jefferson was also hoping that people would become more self-sufficient and make their own goods domestically versus shipping them out to international markets and then receiving goods that came from international markets overseas into the United States. Well, the problem is that not everyone has access or has proper access to the means of making goods domestically that are more easily able to be shipped overseas to America, like, you know, cloth and fabric, for example. Well, Frederick's family saw their vast fortunes gone and had to find different means of making money. So come the summer of 1808, he's out of work. He can't sit around and twirl his thumb and have a pity party, but he decides to experiment with a supply of ice from the Rockwood Ice House. But what he needs to know is simply this. He needs to know why some materials proved He needs to know why some materials have provided better insulation versus others. So he took charcoal and light spongy peat. Peat refers to the plant remnants that have been decayed in water and over time get turned into fuel. So he took two large wooden casks by putting grounded charcoal in one and peat in the other, where he then filled each cask with ice and closed the lids. Now, I will tell you all this right now, that he is not going to be able to get the results he wants overnight. We should be reminded that some experiments, to get the results you want, for one, they don't happen overnight, but it does take a little bit more time than expected. Well, for Frederick here, it's going to take almost 6 weeks to get the results he needs. So basically 40 days later, ice has melted in each cask. And this all was taking place between mid-June into late July of 1808. The melt water in the barrel covered with charcoal turned out to be warm. But as for the water in the barrel that had the peat, that water remained cool. So for Frederick Tudor, he's now come to the realization that peat is the better insulator choice, the better choice for insulation. Well, besides lacking resources of their own to export, what other factors did New Englanders lack from a shipping standpoint? They had rivers that ran just north and south. which meant there wasn't any means for them to have access into the interior of the U.S., ultimately leading to their being dependent on the ocean and East Coast for all riches. Remember, we learned earlier that New Englanders did not have a whole lot of goods to export. They were relying heavily on imports. And once those imports were brought into the wharves of Boston, merchants could not only purchase them, but they could resell them to make a some very good profits. They could sell them domestically to people not only from within New England, but also from the Mid-Atlantic states and as well as down south. Now, the primary custom or practice often resulted in ships not having anything bulk quantity to transport on outward voyage, which meant that ballast, and ballast is, you know, is usually a heavy substance. It usually is in the form of rocks or water. In today's time, it's more so water, but in colonial times and even in the 19th century, a captain and his crew would use rocks as a form of ballast to evenly distribute the weight of a ship depending on how much overall cargo was being transported at any given time. So, given that the primary custom or practice often resulted in ships not having anything bulk quantity to transport on outward voyage, this often meant that the ballast itself would always become an issue when needing to weigh a ship down. Instead of using stones from Boston Harbor, which became time-consuming, and it truly was a time-consuming practice to evenly distribute the stones onto a ship, because if you didn't evenly distribute the stones, then obviously the ship itself could run into a whole host of problems while in transit out along the waters. Frederick Tudor decides instead to propose using ice for ballast purposes, meaning that there would be a freight charge paid to the shipper, but at a low rate. So, yeah, you can use stones, but the thing is that if you use stones for ballast purposes, you're not going to be able to get a freight charge. So ice is unique because it's one of those commodities that nobody's obviously tried to ship before until now under Frederick Tudor's tutelage. But if there are other ship owners who want to use something different that's going to be less time-consuming and they can get money out of it, then why not use ice for ballast purposes? Did the Embargo Act of 1807 ever get repealed? It did. That's good news, but here's the thing. The Embargo Act, folks, did not get repealed until almost 15 months later. It got repealed come March 1st, 1809, just days before Thomas Jefferson's presidency came to an end. So when the Embargo Act was repealed, Congress replaced it by enacting the Non-Intercourse Act, which lifted all embargoes on American shipping except for shipments bound for British and French ports. The intent was to damage British and French economies. That never happened, folks. We just simply did not have the means to destroy their economies. William Tudor, you know, Frederick's brother, this is going to seem a bit odd, but one thing we have to be reminded of is this, folks, is that just because a piece of legislation gets repealed, it doesn't mean that everyone can go about resuming their lives as though nothing happened. No, I can only imagine just how many, it's not so much how many people were out of jobs, I can only imagine how many employers ultimately had to shut down for good, to where they, some of them may never have been able to have reopened. Or if they did, they had a smaller staff. think about it. If they had a large staff when they reopened, it turns out that it probably would have turned out that, for one, it would have taken business a little bit longer to recoup, and two, if you have too many people working right after a halt, how are you going to be able to afford to pay their wages? How can you be able to afford to prove to them that you have enough work for them to be able to make a decent day's living, or a decent wage, not only for short-term but long-term purposes? So William Tudor, while having his watch repaired, he learned from the watchmaker that coal had been discovered on Cape Cod in Martha's Vineyard. So when he tells this to Frederick, Frederick put together a mining company with a committee of six individuals. They went to Cape Cod and found coal specimens, and the same for Martha's Vineyard. As good of an intention as this was, sadly, the venture ultimately came to nothing. In other words, there wasn't enough solid financial backing to pursue this endeavor where some long-term gains would have been significant to have made up for being out of work for the time that Frederick himself, along with countless others, had been deprived of due to that infamous Embargo Act. Late 1809, Frederick, he got put under arrest, folks. He got put under arrest for debt. He owes creditors money. However, thanks to his dad and some friends, they raised enough money to keep him from serving jail or prison time. Basically, Frederick is getting a reprieve. And usually when I think of a reprieve, it's, you know, it's a warning. You have X number of days to, say, redeem yourself, to where if you show that you have been proven worthy and have learned from your mistakes, then we will basically remove the first offense off of your record. Well, it's easy to assume that that there are people out there who simply don't want to learn from their lessons, but I think it's fair to say that Frederick is going to have more than one issue with the law. But it has, in my opinion, it's really not about him being negligent. It's not him. It's not about him being reckless. It's not about him being ignorant. He's trying to do something that so many other people have ridiculed him for, and he's trying to do something that will also help out his family long term. He's trying to do something that, in the eyes of others, is different. He wants to be uncommon. He wants to go places where other people won't go, and he wants to take a resource that is being taken for granted in his eyes by those from within the inner circle who view ice in their eyes as something that could be beneficial, but it's only going to be beneficial to the inner circle. We'll use it to chill our beverages and in our foods, but why should it be sent overseas, given that those people wouldn't know what to do with it? Why should it be sent down into the southern tier of the United States, given that those states of South Carolina, Georgia, Louisiana, for example, they live in agrarian economies? What could they do with something that they've never seen before? So, yeah, this is where Frederick is trying to be different. He's trying to broaden the horizon and prove the skeptics, not just in general, but from those from within the inner circle. He's trying to basically prove them that they are dead wrong. Well, what came about for Frederick come April of 1810? Well, for one, he was already in Havana, Cuba, where he went about securing a monopoly. Secondly, in April of 1810, two shiploads or cargoes of ice came from Boston, which led to $5,600 in sales by August. Gosh, that is awesome. Ice sales by the end of the shipping season of 1810 came to $7,400. I mean, he's not that far off from $10,000. And it was in 1810 This particular ice shipping season marked a first in the form of netting profits. I tell you, Frederick has come a long way from when he first started in late 1805, but he's still got other challenges that lie ahead. Did Frederick still owe money to multiple people within Boston by early March 1812? Yes, come March 9th, he got arrested and sent to prison as a debtor. He wasn't even 30 years old, but he's 28 and a half years old. Frederick acquired money over time to pay back the debt, and he got released from jail, where he soon afterwards arranged another ice shipment to Havana. He also created a basement store for ice in Boston, knowing supplies would need to be there during the summertime if it meant shipping ice cargoes consistently. Well, here comes another setback. The War of 1812, per its early beginnings, after Congress declared war come June 18th of 1812, President Madison signed the Declaration. The War of 1812, in its early beginnings, did contribute to another embargo on American trade. Frederick is forced to abandon the Havana trade altogether, only, folks. And this, to me, is very unfortunate. It was bad enough that he's forced to abandon the Havana trade altogether, but the shipment of ice that was supposed to have been sent to Havana, folks, it melted away without even getting sold. You know, it's really a shame that the inner circle, the Brahmins, could not have come to their senses and said, hey, we'll take your ice. We could perhaps work out an arrangement where if we take your ice, would you be willing to pay us back in installments? That's easier said than done. But if I was in Frederick's shoes and I saw that this ice sat there and it sadly melted away, I mean, yes, I would be very upset. I would also be upset with those from within the inner circle. I would, you know, love to have said to one of them, how could you do this? How could you just sit back and not do anything? Think about this. There are people out there who would kill to have ice to chill their beverages, to preserve their foods. Not only am I affected by this embargo, but I'm losing money. How would you feel if you were in my shoes? Yeah, I think we all would feel that way, to say the least. But because of this embargo on American trade, and Frederick now having to abandon the Havana trade altogether and losing this particular ice shipment without getting sold, by July of 1812, folks, Frederick was in debt up to $38,772. It's one thing to be in debt a couple hundred dollars, but to be in debt almost $40,000, and knowing that no ice trade is available anytime in the foreseeable future, what are you going to do? How are you going to survive? How are you going to keep your sanity in check when so much is against you now? Well, given that there's no ice trade available come winter of 1813, Frederick does something different. He remains steadfast by going as far as finding a shipyard, where he assembled a crew whom built a 60-foot-long ship called Black Swan. So on May 1st of 1813, prior to the Black Swan's departure, Frederick was arrested on board the vessel for failure to pay a $300 debt. The Black Swan never prevailed on the waters, and by summer of 1814, folks, he was arrested three more times for debt. He was jailed twice. The ice trade is halted by the War of 1812. But maybe it's fair to say that better days are going to lie ahead after the War of 1812 officially ends with the Treaty of Ghent and the final battle, the Battle of New Orleans, which took place just after the start of the new year in January of 1815. But in late 1815, we have to go to November 1st of 1815, Frederick loads up a ship of ice that will set sail for Havana. I tell you, I can't imagine being out of work. It's one thing to be out of work or to be let go of your job, from your job, but to be completely impacted in a time of war to where you can't ship out anything, that is, and this is your own business. Yeah, it's a livelihood that not only is destroyed, but how are you going to make up for lost revenue, knowing that you have mounting debts that don't have any end in sight either. So just when you think that you've dodged one bullet, there's always another bullet that can creep up out of nowhere to cause even more irreparable harm, to where you really don't know where a light at the end of the tunnel can be found. Well, besides sailing to Cuba in November 1815 with a shipment full of ice, what else did Frederick have on board his vessel? He had with him proper materials to build a brand new state-of-the-art ice house, including carpenters from Boston whom would go about constructing it. Frederick is not a fan. I found this interesting, and I probably don't blame, if I was in Frederick Tudor's shoes, maybe I'd feel the same way too. He's not a fan of Havana, Cuba's climate, considering how hot the weather was. Yeah, summertime down in the Caribbean, it's hot, oppressive. Well, I mean, think of the Deep South in the United States. I read this the other night online that Mississippi is one of the most humid states in America. So I can't imagine what the heat would be like there in the Delta region during the summer times. I also think when I think of states where the heat is prevalent down Deep South, you know, think of Alabama, think of Georgia, even South Carolina, it can be very, very hot, to say the least. So if it's bad enough that how hot the weather itself was, there's also the presence of yellow fever. However, despite the fact that, yes, Havana, Cuba is a hot place in terms of oppressive heat and a strong presence of yellow fever, up to this point, Havana, Cuba had become the one primary place for Frederick himself to have been able to have been consistent with the overall ice trade market. I mean, yes, he tried in St. Pierre, Martinique, but it didn't prevail, even though he hasn't given up there. But Havana, Cuba really has done a lot of wonders for him. As for Cuba, I learned that during this time in the early 19th century that Cuba was known for exporting coffee, tobacco, and sugar to the United States. Usually when I think of the states that are growing tobacco, you know, I think of Virginia, the Carolinas, states down in the Deep South as the leading exporters of tobacco, especially in the colonial days, like with Virginia. That Virginia was known for not only growing tobacco, but exporting it to England on a consistent basis. Of course, that became the crop that ultimately saved the Virginia colony in the 17th century during the early years of the Jamestown settlement. But we move to February of 1816, February 10th of 1816, that is, an official site was agreed upon to where an ice house in Havana would get built. 3 days later, on February the 13th of 1816, carpenters began building an ice house in anticipation of the vessel George Washington's eventual arrival with ice cargo. As for the carpenters, they had no more than 2 weeks at their helm to put up 159 cedar posts that would form the framework of the building. So yeah, we just, you know, can't be sitting around twirling our thumbs doing whatever it is we want to do. You know, they had deadlines back then to get things done. They didn't have to worry about a lot of bureaucratic red tape like there is now. February 25th of 1816, the vessel George Washington docked in Havana. The ice that was in the cargo hold of the vessel George Washington, it had to be placed in the unfinished ice house, which meant the top component or the layer did not get sealed from above, resulting in ice melting. Well, Frederick isn't going to sit back. He's got to take charge again. He's got to conduct another experiment here, folks, so that he doesn't run into another situation like this. So Frederick goes about measuring loss ratio by gathering meltwater from the ice house drain in a wooden barrel. He ultimately put an extra layer of sawdust on the outside of the building, but that even failed as well. How so? Well, it failed due to tin, white metal, heating up in the sun, thus negatively impacting the sawdust. Frederick turned to blankets. His next option was that he had to turn to blankets for protecting ice over the sawdust. Ice loss was reduced to under 20 pounds an hour. The Havana ice house was made from timber, and the outer walls were 25 feet long and 25 feet high. Ice store walls inside stood 19 feet long and 16 feet high. Sadly, there are no pictures nor illustrations that have ever been found, although historians do know that the insulation that was used was sawdust and peat packed between inner and outer walls, and a drain taking away the meltwater. A very revolutionary thing that Frederick did, and knowing that he was able to do this, is very revolutionary unto itself. Given how successful ice sales had become going to Cuba come summer of 1816, what did Frederick begin experimenting with on the side? Preserving fruit. Well, Frederick asked for a shipment of Baldwin apples to get packed in barrels and placed in the hold next to the ice. Well, when the Baldwin apples arrived, they arrived in very good shape to where he sold them for a profit. Now, I do know this, and I know this because I had read this from a book some time back, and I remember doing a podcast book topic series on it. It was about about Paul Revere's ride. But long story short, there was an officer whom fought at both Lexington and Concord when the shots were first fired. Matter of fact, hard to believe, on April 19th. That's a week from tomorrow, folks. Or no, a week from Friday, I should say. A week from this Friday, the week after, I should say, being April 19th, that'll mark 249 years. 249 years ago was when the first shots were fired around the world at Lexington and Concord, and hard to believe that it'll be 250 years come next year. That, to me, is quite unreal, to say the least. But there was an officer named Lawami Baldwin, and his family was credited for growing apples on their farm that became known as the Baldwin apples. So whenever you bite into a Baldwin apple or buy Baldwin apples, think of Officer Lawami Baldwin and his family, whom were responsible for getting the Baldwin apples produced. Well, August of 1816 saw the schooner Perigo enter Havana with a cargo of ice. Well, Frederick sought to ship Cuban fruit, oranges, plantains, bananas, coconuts, pears up north to New York. You know, to think there was a time, folks, that you couldn't go to a market maybe at one time you couldn't, but as time progressed, you could. But, you know, nowadays you go into a grocery store, you can find limes, lemons, oranges, you can find bananas, pears, you know, all of that's great. But there was a time when you couldn't. So in terms of the level of accessibility that we know today, is far, on one hand, it's far greater than it was, say, 100 or 200 years ago. But the bottom line is that whatever we buy at the store now, it's so easy to take for granted. But we must be reminded that there was a time when you could not buy certain things at a market if you wanted them. In the case of, say, limes or lemons or oranges, they had to come from overseas. So anyways, for Frederick Tudor, he went about placing 3 tons of hay. That's, 2,000 tons is the equivalent to 1 pound, or 2,000, let me get this straight here. 1 ton is the equivalent to 2,000 pounds. So 3 tons of hay, 6,000 pounds of hay. He used this as insulation on top of the fruit, with 15 tons of ice in the hold. The Paragon left Cuba under very hot weather. September 17th, the Paragon arrived into New York. A large portion of the fruit sadly rotted away, leading Frederick to believe that he had packed more fruit into less ice volumes. In other words, he probably should have doubled. At max, he probably should have doubled the overall tonnage of ice, or worst case scenario, he probably should have taken on maybe another 5 to 7 more tons of ice on top of the 15 tons that were already in the hold. But unfortunately, coming to the realization that he had packed more fruit into less ice volumes led him to believe that the fruit itself rotted away because there was not enough high concentration of ice volume. However, the two fruits that did that were able to sell significantly to markets in New York were the limes and the oranges. Unfortunately, Frederick did lose $2,000 in this venture. He probably would have been better off just doing what he had done in terms of just sold the Baldwin apples, which he did for a profit. But hey, this is all trial and error, folks. This is where you have to learn. And yes, sometimes it may not be pleasant in terms of not getting the results that you intended for. But if there's anything good that came out of this one, is that at least the limes and the oranges had not completely rotted to where they were able to sell for, you know, reasonable price. Well, in the midst of falling deeper into debt, what glimmer of hope got offered to Frederick through Brother William? William met with General Thomas Pinckney, former War of 1812 Major General Officer and a one-time South Carolina governor, whom expressed interest in having potential ice trade expand into South Carolina. Well, Frederick didn't stay long in Boston. A letter from General Pinckney he received, it stated that he and another relative would back the importation of ice to South Carolina. Francis Lee, a Bostonian merchant, lent Frederick $300 to go down to Charleston. November 1st, 1816, Frederick sailed for Charleston, South Carolina, knowing he had 4 outstanding loans against him that he needed to repay. He's really the only member of the Tudor family whom is working right now. He's really the only member of his family whom had any real chance of saving Rockwood to restoring his family's former wealth state or their wealth status. Basically, Frederick is stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, Frederick, you know, he loves Massachusetts, but he knows that if he stays there, the longer he stays there, the greater the likelihood that he will get caught, sent back into a debtor's prison. And who's to say that if he gets, I mean, we've already learned that, yes, he's been jailed a couple of times, but who's to say if he gets put back into a slammer again that he might not get out at a reasonable time? You know, it's one thing to ship ice, but remember, folks, ice doesn't last forever. If you don't leave out of port on time and make it into your destination on time, who's to say that your full cargo of ice is going to remain intact? And who's to say that that if it doesn't remain intact, that you'll even get a profit that breaks 50-50? There's so many unknowns when knowing that even time itself is not always to your side. Well, thank you for your time. As always, this wraps up this episode, or I should say podcast segment episode, of Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade. When I'm on the air again next, we're going to talk about when Frederick Tudor himself arrives into Charleston, South Carolina, and how most notably the politicians of South Carolina view his request for a monopoly. That's just some of the many things that we will talk about the next time I'm on the air. I don't know how soon I will be back on the air again next. I know that I will be on assignment starting tomorrow. And hey, there's nothing wrong with being on assignment. Being on assignment is relevant. Being on assignment can yield to a lot of good things as well. So when I'm on the air again next, I will look forward to sharing with you all what we will be discussing in the next podcast segment episode to the Frozen Water Trade. Well, thank you for your time as always, and wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe.